there's a little bit of a change from where we ended in chapter 3 coming into chapter 4. I think James is really still dealing with some of the same issues that existed among the brethren to whom he was writing. So with that said, who can give us a quick summary of what we dealt with at the end of chapter 3 last week? Anybody? All right.
Differences are selfishness associated with that below, and the other characteristics of both of the wisdom that's from above is for pure, peaceful, general, even way of things.
Right. Unfortunately, we ended on a positive note last week as we mainly looked at how wisdom from above will affect us and the way that we'll live, the more selfless way. The peace that'll come as a result of it, but we also notice that contrast with the worldly wisdom that leads to conflict and disorder. Now, like I said, we kind of ended on a positive note because the very last verse of chapter 3 says what? Can I just read verse 18 for us? All right, Daniel. All right, do you notice a key word mentioned twice there when there's righteousness? Peace. But immediately we come from ending chapter 3 with peace being emphasized when there's righteousness. And we come into chapter 4 and we really find right the opposite. So we're kind of right back to that conflict that we were noticing in chapter 3. As we see here, the problem of worldliness versus godliness. So let me get my clicker going. And really the first five verses focus on more the negative side, the idea of the worldliness that's there. And so question one asks, what did they have in or within them, depending on your version exactly how it's worded, and what did it lead to among them? Kevin? All right. Is passion good or bad? Okay, good answer. Passion can be good if it's the right kind of passion, but it can also be bad if it's on the wrong things. And I think we touched on that a little bit with the wisdom, whether we're pursuing the heavenly wisdom or the earthly wisdom. Here we see the passion is more of a negative thing. And I'll just go ahead and put that there, depending on your version, exactly how it's worded. We see the idea of passions, desires, pleasures, cravings that are all mentioned there. That's what they had within them, these passions and these cravings that were at work within them. And they were of the earthly nature that we noticed toward the end of chapter 3. So what was the result of them? Well, what did it lead to among them? The peace that's emphasized at the end of chapter 3, right? Right, the opposite. Yeah, because of their passions and desires and their cravings were focused on earthly things, we see here that quarrels and wars and fights came as a result. And as we emphasized last week, it was Wednesday, that is a result. When we're focused on ourselves and we're selfish in nature, you want what you want and I want what I want. And so that leads to conflict that's created among us. And so we're not really surprised when we see this. Now, when it talks about the idea of wars and fights among you, did it lead to the kind of wars and fights we see like maybe between Ukraine and Russia right now? Is it that kind of war or that kind of fight? What do you think's the idea here? It could lead to a physical confrontation.
I think the next question, the you question, one of those terms in there makes you question to what level it's going and ask yourself, how far did it go?
Right.
One thing I think about is
Right. And that's what we're really seeing take place, is spiritual division. And I think it's more the spiritual side of it that he's describing here, is the wars that come as a result. There may have been some physical conflict, but it's mainly that spiritual battle that's existing, the battle of the wills, if you want to think about it that way. I'm fighting for my rights, you're fighting for yours, and so that does create a war and a battle to a certain degree. But I'll just go ahead and put up a second question since Ralph mentioned it. What did they do? And I mentioned the you because over and over it talks about you. What was the result? What was it that they were doing? It was kind of what we touched on even in verse 1. Ed? Right. Those are pretty strong. And really how you answer this question probably depends on the version that you have. This is one of those unfortunate times that versions are worded enough differently that you come away with different ideas. Now, if you have the ESV or I think New American Standard, several others, it's worded more like this in the first part of verse 2. Somebody have the New King James? I know some of you use it.
If you lust and do not have, you murder and covet and cannot obtain, you fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask.
Right. So if you look at that, the wording of the two, it can kind of lead to different ideas or conclusions. But I think without us getting into a real technical discussion over which versions are correct on this, I think we see the overall idea is going to be the same. The result's still the same. It's still negative. It's still not a good thing. When what they are doing is desiring, lusting, coveting, those things, well, first of all, when they desired and they lusted and they coveted, what was the result? Did they get those things that they were desiring? No, they didn't. So they had these desires for these things, but those desires just aren't satisfied. And think about that just in a general sense when it comes to when we desire the things of this world. And we may get what we think we're after, but do we really get satisfaction? Usually not. If your desire is for money, well, how much is enough? You never really get enough. If your desire is for the possessions of this world, when do you get enough? Dave?
I'm thinking about in the Old Testament, I believe it's in Kings. It can go the other way. When Solomon asks not for long life, not for wealth, he asks for wisdom, something to make a little appropriate for the people. And then God tells him, I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart that, so that there will never have been anyone like him, nor will there ever be. Moreover,
right.
That pendulum swung way the other way, Solomon, because he had an appropriate heart and he asked.
Right. And that's a great example, because Solomon had some of the things that we're talking about that they were longing for and desiring and coveting, and they really didn't get them. They didn't really get satisfaction from them. God turns around and gives Solomon basically those same things. Well, what's the difference? Even if we're talking about earthly, physical, tangible things, it's our...
I think he asked for he looked to God with faith and love. He asked him,
okay. Right. Right. I think we'll see the answer to that question in just a second. That's ask it now, Tim. Right. And I think that's more how James intends it here, is more of that spiritual sense. Just like, if I can find here in my notes, Galatians chapter 5 and verse 15. Do you remember what Paul accused them of doing to one another? Being cannibals, really. What did he say about them in Galatians 5 verse 15? You do what to one another? Bite and devour. Were they being cannibalistic? Were they literally biting and devouring each other? No, not in the physical sense. But spiritually, that's what they were doing. And so I think that's what James is referring to here. There is a war between them. It may not be physical, may not come to blows, but there is this battle in this war, battle of the wills, again, that we see between them. And as far as what was the result, that they didn't get what they really wanted, so they murder and they fight and they quarrel. Just this battle continues between them. We're so far from the peace that exists with righteousness at the end of chapter 3 because their hearts aren't on peace. Their hearts aren't on righteousness. Again, it's all about me and what I want and what I desire. And what I desire and what I want mainly for me. And that touches on our next question, and that is, what did they not have? And I added part of that to my question, so you may not see that, tying in a little bit of verse 3 here, or verse 2 as well. Why did they not have received? Let's start with the end of verse 2. At the end of verse 2, he said, you do not have why? Okay, so part of it is that they didn't ask. But what's he mean by this when he said they didn't ask? Well, what do you think he has in mind? Prayer?
Perhaps an assumption that part of it should be mine, so I'm going to take it regardless.
Okay, maybe that's part of it. Yeah, I think the idea of prayer, who said prayer? All right, maybe a few of you. I think that's more what he has in mind here. Some things we just don't get because we don't ask God for them. And sometimes it's easy for us to get so caught up in our physical struggles, our physical desires, that we just don't ask God.
Sometimes we think we can accomplish things ourselves.
Right. Right. It's kind of that example where God's our spare tire. We just pull him out in case of emergency. When he needs to be the steering wheel, where he's always there and in control. But sometimes it's easy when we get caught up in the things of this world, where we're looking for worldly solutions and worldly answers, and so we don't get answers because we don't even take the time to ask God. So that's part of why we may have these struggles, because we don't turn to God and we don't ask God. But why else did he say that we don't have or don't receive in the very next verse? Maybe we do ask God, but we still don't get. Why not? All right. Yeah, the wrong motivation. Asking for me. And I think this gets back to David's comment a while ago about Solomon. Why did God give Solomon all these riches and all this wealth? And maybe he doesn't give it to everybody else.
I was thinking about David's comment that Solomon asked for wisdom, but not for even his own sake.
Right.
Asked for wisdom to be discerning to benefit the people of the nation.
Right. Right, even the wisdom. Solomon didn't want the wisdom just so everybody would be impressed by him. He wanted wisdom so he could effectively lead people. He didn't even ask for the riches and for the wealth. But God seemed to understand that if I could give that to Solomon, he will use it the right way. Why is it sometimes we may ask, you know, we want a better job, we want more money, I want that raise. Well, why do we want those things? Like to have a bigger house, you know, need to fund that trip. We want to do all these worldly things, and nothing wrong necessarily with those things. But if that's our only motivation for asking God is to satisfy our physical, fleshly desires, then we shouldn't be surprised, even when we ask God, if we don't get those things. Solomon asked with the right motive and the right intention, and so God freely gave to him. But if we ask, even if we include God and we ask Him with the wrong motives, and don't be surprised when we don't receive, when we don't get. Any other thoughts or comments? Daniel? Right. You notice we bring that laundry list of things we want, but the reasons that we want them. Maybe kind of sobering for us sometimes before we get into our petitions to God. Why am I petitioning God for this? Why am I asking for this? Well, what is my ulterior motive? Well, then we see in verse 4, James uses some pretty strong language to those that he's writing. He's already talked about the wars and the fights that they have just because they're either not asking God or asking for the wrong motives. Then he turns around in verse 4 and calls them what? Adulterers. Why did James call them adulterous? First part of the question. Right. Yeah, we see a lot of examples of that in the Old Testament, similar language being used to describe God's people and their relationship with God. Gary?
Yeah, God's supposed to be their husband, and they were faithful to Him because they went after other gods, crying out loud. And this person makes that same point. People want to be friends of the world. Well, that's being unfaithful to God, who is supposed to be their head and their spouse in that spirit of sense.
Okay. Hans?
I think this kind of applies to this whole section, but a lot of times people can get kind of comfortable in the sins they're kind of okay with, or, you know, so, but when James is using words like murder and war and adultery, that's like shaking them a little bit and saying, you know, what you might not think of as bad as those things is just as bad.
Right. But those are the kind of words that make the news. From that war. There's several ways we can do that. Make a liar out of God. We can do that in our relationship with Him. But, quit Tim.
The other thing, other than just the friendship of the world,
Right. So what's this idea? I'm sorry, Daniel. Go ahead.
As Gary had alluded to, in 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 and 16, it says, do not love the world or the things of this world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in this world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not the Father, but of this is of this world. And so, as you said, you're essentially cheating on God with the flesh of the world.
Right. And that's a great passage where John's, I think, dealing with the same kind of issues there that James is here. When you think about the idea of adultery and friendship, I'll just go ahead and put it up here the way he puts it. Friendship with the world is enmity with God. Don't we use similar language sometimes today when we talk about adulterous situations? Maybe that somebody's husband gets a little too friendly with the secretary at work. We use that kind of language sometimes. Two people are a little too friendly with each other. And what often happens? What starts off maybe innocent quickly becomes not so innocent. And so that's what James is saying. When you're friendly with the world, well, you're basically committing adultery, spiritual adultery against God. That's pretty serious.
Verse 80 uses the double-minded concept. So yeah, who are they trying to be loyal to? Well, that their affections are divided.
Mm-hmm. And that's what often happens. Somebody starts off a little too friendly with the secretary, and pretty soon they end up with kind of a double life. They go home and they play one role at home, but then they go to work and they're playing a different role there. James saying that's what can happen to us spiritually. We're kind of trying to live a double life. We're double-minded. We're trying to satisfy those physical, fleshly desires by being friendly with the world and playing footsie with them. But then at the same time, we're trying to keep our allegiance with God. And James is trying to tell us, you're an adulterer. You're not maintaining a relationship with both. You're cheating on God by being a friend of the world. And that is strong language that he's using, because I think he's trying to make a strong point with them. And so this idea of being friends with the world, they belong to God in the sense that they're wearing God's name, just as if we're married to somebody else, we're wearing their name, but they're too friendly with the world and unfaithful to him. Just because the spouse has your name doesn't mean that they're faithful to you. And that was kind of their situation when it came to their relationship with God. And so what we see is friendship with the world makes us unfaithful to God, the role of adultery there, and also an enemy to Him. Well, think about being somebody's enemy or at enmity with them. What does it mean to be an enemy?
Opposed.
Okay. Opposed to. Some versions use other words here. Anybody have a New American Standard? Hostility. That's what we create with God when we try to be friends with the world. We're hostile toward God when we're friendly with the world. The NIV even uses a stronger word, hater. We hate God when we love the world. That's back to John's point, really, there in 1 John chapter 2. You can't say you love God while you love the world. You really hate God. You're cheating on Him. You're an adulterer. You've got enmity between you and Him. All because you're trying to maintain this relationship with the world that just can't be done. And as he says there in verse 5, or do you think the Scripture says in vain, the Spirit who dwells in us yearns jealously? God is a jealous God. And just like a spouse may become jealous of their spouse being unfaithful or being too friendly with someone else, God is jealous of us. when we're a little too friendly with the world. So that's the problem. We've got too much worldliness in us. Any other thoughts or comments on that before we kind of shift gears a little, Mike? Right. Kind of like when we think we can multitask. I mean, we really can't. You may have two things going at the same time and switch back and forth between them, and maybe that's your idea of multitasking. But even with that, just the way our minds work, we're focused on one, and then we're focused on the other. You can't be focused on really both at the same time. Your mind doesn't work that way. And spiritually, it doesn't work that way. We can't try to keep a balance between God and the world. Either one has all our attention or the other has all our attention. And when the world has our attention, then we're forsaking God. It's just that simple. Well, we can't maintain the right relationship with both. And so James has a solution for their problem as we move into verses 6 through 12 here. And the solution's really godliness. We see the transition here as we come from chapter 5 into chapter 6 with a certain word. I think just about any version you have, verse 6 begins with what word? But. In spite of how negative and bleak things are in these first few verses when we're focused on earthly things, but there's another side. We can get out of this situation. We can leave the worldliness behind. We can actually be in a relationship where God does hear our prayers and does answer them, and we don't have all this conflict. Because God, as verse 6 says, He gives more grace. There's been an absence of grace in verse 1 through 5. There's no grace there. There was war and conflict and enmity. But James reminds them, grace is still available. But how? Who receives the grace of God? Who puts an end to all this conflict and animosity and war and hatred that we see in the first few verses? The humble. You want to receive the grace of God? You want to get out of this world of conflict and animosity and God not answering your prayers, not giving you what you're asking for? There is another side. Are you ready to humble yourself to God? His grace is abundant to those who will. And if you look here in our context, here in verse 6, he says, therefore, God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. You come down a few verses further, down to verse 10, and again, he really makes this same point. That for the humble, things can be different. For those who are humble, God will exalt you. He'll hear your prayers. He'll answer them. He'll lift you up. But it's all about being humble. Be humble and receive the grace of God. And so we could just end the lesson right there. I could just tell you, be humble and you'll have God's grace. But we're skipping a few verses there, right? So let's look at those verses in between, and James kind of unpacks for us what it looks like in our lives if we are truly humble before God, if we're humbling ourselves before Him. Question 6, what must we do in relation to God and then also the devil, and what are the results when we do? If we're going to humble ourselves, well, what does that involve? Verse 7. submission. If we're going to humble ourselves before God, that means that we're submitting to God. This word here, submit, really comes from a military word. And it's defined as to be arranged or ordered under. And so we're submitting to God, similar to like if you're in a battle situation and someone has defeated you and you just submit yourself before them. You're laying yourself at their feet. You're at their mercy now. And so when we humble ourselves before God, that's what we do. We give ourselves over to God's authority. We let Him take control, in a sense. Excuse me, 2 Timothy 2, verses 3 through 4, talk about how we submit to God because of our desire to please Him. We're not living for ourselves now. We're living for God, and because we're living for Him, we give Him full control. We let Him dictate how we're going to live and what we're going to do. That's what we do in relation to God. We submit to God. And when we submit to God, what are we going to do? What should just be a natural reaction when it comes to the devil? Yeah, we're not going to submit to him. This is a time we hold our ground. We don't submit to the devil. We resist him. Peter makes this point pretty strong there in 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 8 and 9. He talks about how the devil walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. You remember what he said we do with that roaring lion who wants to devour us?
Resist him strong in faith.
Right. Resist him strong. So we're submitting and totally submitting ourselves to God, but we stand firm against Satan. We don't give him an inch in our life. Because if we do, he'll be like that lion who's ready to devour us. So we stand firmly against him because we're totally submitting to God. And then also what's involved when it comes to our relationship with God. And we submit to him. Well, first of all, I meant to put that up. We resist the devil. It says the devil will flee from us. Now let me ask this. Do you believe what James says? If we resist the devil, he'll flee from us. James says it, I believe it. But what does he mean by that when he says the devil will flee from us? We just resist the devil, we stand up to him, and then he just leaves us alone ever to bother us again.
Well, it's not the never kind of bother us again thing. It's taken from the life of Jesus.
Right.
He resisted the devil very well, very strong in Matthew 4. And the devil left him, angels ministered to him, but then the devil definitely tried to tempt him on other occasions.
Right. And Matthew's account doesn't specifically mention that part, but Luke's kind of gives us a little foreshadowing to it. Remember what Luke's account of the temptation said after the devil left him? Right. He left him until an opportune time. There were going to be times in Jesus' life after he took that stand firm against him that Jesus was going to be weak and subject to temptation in some ways. We know one of those is when Peter comes to him later and says, Lord, you know, you don't need to go through all that. And Satan recognized Satan working through him and said, get behind me. And so there are going to be times we take that strong stand against Satan. We resist him. He flees from us, but it's only going to be for the moment. Every day we're going to have to make that decision. I'm not going to give in to Satan today. And maybe multiple times throughout the day, Satan's trying us this way. I'm not going to give in. He's tempting us with this. Nope, get behind me, Satan. It's a constant battle that we undergo. But when we do firmly stand against him, at least for that time, he will flee from us. We have that promise from James. And it's not just a matter of submitting to God and saying, God, you now have control of my life. What else do we do in relation to God? Verse 8 says what? Right, draw near. If you couldn't see Gary's visual, We draw near. The word here for drawing near literally means to join one thing to another. And so we're joining ourselves to God. Back to the idea of the adultery. Does that joining together sound kind of familiar? What do we do when we get married? We draw near to another. We become one with them. And so when we totally submit ourselves to God, we turn away from Satan, we draw near to God, and we become one with Him. And what happens as a result when we draw near to God? He draws near to us too. While ago, God was away from us. We're seeking our own will, trying to satisfy our fleshly desires. Even when we'd pray to God, God didn't hear us. He didn't draw near to us because our motivation was wrong. But when we turn to God and we submit to Him, we want to follow after Him and we draw near, He's waiting to draw near to us. And we draw near and we experience His grace in our life. James also says part of humbling ourselves before God involves our hands and our hearts. Well, what do our hands and our hearts have to do with us humbling ourselves to God? What about the hands?
Represents all our actions, right? All our behavior.
Right. It's really just a symbolic thing that he mentions there in relation to our hands and our heart, and I'll just put it up there. Are our hands only things that need to be cleansed? And again, is he talking physically or spiritually here? I think we understand it's spiritual, figurative cleansing that we do. And I think Gary's point is it's not just our hands, but our hands are reflective of really the whole submission that we're given to him. Think back to the Old Testament system. Were there times that God did require them to wash their hands? What about the priests when they go into the tabernacle? They had to wash their hands and their feet. Now, was it because they were physically dirty and they didn't want to get the tabernacle dirty? Maybe. But it was more of a symbolic thing. As they washed their hands, they were washing themselves, even spiritually, to be clean as they entered into the presence of God. And so it's the idea of James here, that we cleanse our hands. And we cleanse our hands because we are what? Sinners. It's not physical dirt, it's spiritual dirt that we're trying to remove from us when we cleanse our hands. And part of cleansing our hands is purifying our hearts, because as we've touched on throughout our study here in James, it all begins in the heart. If we can purify our hearts, then we'll truly be pure. And we're back to the idea here of being double-minded, and we've already talked about that. We can't really be pleasing to the world and pleasing to God at the same time. When we cleanse our hands, We cleanse our hearts and purify it. We're turning our back to the world. We're resisting the devil. And we're wholly focused on God at this point. And then we see verse 9 tells us something else that we need to do. Lament and mourn and weep. What's that have to do with humbling ourselves before God? Well, what kind of lamenting and mourning and weeping is he talking about?
Over our sin that separates us from him.
Right. It's over the sin that we've let come between us and him. I'm assuming it's about what you were going to say, John. Right. When we've committed adultery on our mate, And we see the hurt and the heartbreak in their eyes as we stand before them. And it breaks our heart knowing how we've broken theirs. It breaks God's heart when we sin, when we turn from Him and turn to the world. And how can we see that kind of heartbreak in Him and it not break our hearts too? Because we've done something that severed that relationship that He did so much for us to have. To me, that's part of the Lord's Supper every Sunday. We're being reminded of His great sacrifice for us because of our sin, because we're sinners. But yet He loved us so much that He was willing to make that ultimate sacrifice in sending His Son to die for us. It ought to break our hearts when we realize what our sin has led to and how it's hindered our relationship with God and what it's required for us to be right with Him again. We need to lament and mourn and weep. We need to let our laughter be turned to mourning and our joy to gloom. Christians are to be happy and rejoice, but we rejoice because of the grace of God that we experience. But we mourn because of what it took for us to receive that grace from God. And so we kind of answered the question, I guess, already as Paul talks about this point there in 2 Corinthians chapter 7. That's the idea that he's talking about, that we're made sorry. Not again the kind of sorry we got caught in our sin, but sorry when we realize what our sin has done. And so as he describes it here, it's sorry in a godly manner and a sorrow that leads to repentance. A change of direction. That's where we start to draw near to God. We quit going away from God and we want to come near to God. That's what the sorrow leads us to do, is come back to Him, that uniting with Him, drawing close to Him. And He's kind of like that prodigal son's father. He's waiting for us to turn back to Him, waiting to draw near to us too. And then James also deals a little bit with judging here toward the end of our context for today. What type of judging is James condemning here?
Don't mean to slow you down. I know time is short. I just wanted to comment on that previous section.
Mm-hmm.
I love how James is basically reteaching the Beatitudes. I mean, he's got everyone.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I'm glad you brought it up. But we touched on that sort of at the beginning of our study of James, a lot of the comparison between James and the Sermon on the Mount. And this is one of the examples where we see it. So what about the idea of judging? What type of judging is James condemning here when he says we speak evil of a brother and judge our brother? Ed? Right. It's a judging that obviously lacks the love that God has shown toward us in His judgment. And so if our heart's been broken as we come to realize how much God loves us and all that He's done for us, how can we turn around and show harshness toward our brother and not show the same love in return? And what are we actually doing when we judge this way? We're speaking evil of the law. The law is based on the love of God for us. God gave us the law trying to help us be right with Him. And so as we judge others, it ought to be with that same attitude, realizing the law is there to help us be right, not just to point fingers and condemn. So show the same love toward our brethren that God has shown toward us. Well, I guess we are out of time for the day, so we'll go ahead and end here, and we'll move a little further into chapter 4 Wednesday night. Thank you. Morning, Tegan. Got Smarties?
He needs them.
He's not smart enough.
No, he
needs a little help.
You doing all right today, brother?
Doing well. How are y'all?
Doing well. Yeah, Heather's in the house. She wasn't good. Managed to get the boys out.
Well, good. I know what you mean. Managing to get them out sometimes it's not easy.